fighting for America.
We've got some fundamental choices to make about the kind of country we want to be.
We have 47 new members of Congress on the Republican side who've never had the chance to cast their vote to repeal Obamacare.
Fighting for Idaho.
This guy that talked about when he was 6 years old, if he wanted to be a girl, I want to be a pumpkin pie. But that doesn't mean I can climb up on the table at Thanksgiving and let everybody pick at me.
Fighting for you.
I just want to thank you, Kevin, for being there. You put your head on the line all the time. Your neck is out there. But we appreciate you and those who call in.
Boise's Mr. Right.
God bless.
Kevin Miller in the Morning, winner of the 2014 Marconi Radio Award on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
KIDO, Kevin Miller in the Morning. You know, I get jealous every time I see this guy on TV, Fox, CNN, Face the Nation, Meet the Press. Who knows what's next? He's got shows on 27 networks. Mike Baker joins us once again. Mr. Baker, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I'm gonna be on The Voice next. That'll be the next. I'm going on to singing competitions now.
I was going to say you'd replace Blake Shelton.
Yeah. No, I mean competing.
Oh, well, you're
yeah.
It here first.
Yeah, it's off my bucket list.
Now, let's talk a little bit about what you do when you're not on the little screen, the big screen, and everywhere else. Talk a little bit about what you do for a living.
Yeah, I got very lucky when I got out of the agency and started a business called Diligence with a very good friend of mine who came out of the British teams, out of their SBS, which is their version of the SEALs and MI5. And so we put together a company. We had no business experience. We were in London and set this thing up. Had no money. Literally walking down the street after we decided to do this. And had no idea how we were going to get mobile phones, how we were going to put groceries on the table. And we got very fortunate, very lucky. It's all about information, intelligence, security services. And so essentially what we do now, we've been fortunate enough to hire really smart people. They keep the trains running on time. We've met a lot of great folks out there. We've developed some very good client relationships, and it's all about intelligence. They use it for due diligence. They use it for competitive intelligence purposes, strategic intelligence, large-scale investigations, security services like risk and threat consulting, kidnap, ransom, extortion, whatever it may be, and training. And again, I think that, you know, not having gone to business school, not having been in business, when we started this thing, I'm a firm believer in the fact that you need luck. I always thought in the agency, I spent all my time overseas, and I never was involved in an operation that didn't have an element of luck. And if you don't have that, then things are heading south pretty quick. So, you know, we don't like to pat ourselves on the back too much about the business experience. We just feel like we got a couple of things right, and that was primarily sticking in a box, staying with what we knew, you know, gathering intelligence. And the security services side of things, and we hired good people. And then we kind of backed off a little bit and let them do what they know how to do.
Recently, the president was in town. What happens when the president comes to town as far as the big security blanket? We see Air Force One. I'm sure everything is monitored, traffic controlled. What happens that you can tell us that we don't see?
Well, most of the security operation is, as you pointed out, is off the radar. So most of it is the thing. And just like with counterterrorism, just like with the war on terror, most of the security operations, everybody sees they got to get their shoes off. They got to walk through a metal detector at the airport. But what happens behind the scenes is, you know, 98% of it. So the president coming into town, it was exciting. There was a lot of, you know, a lot of excitement here for that, regardless of which side of the aisle you happen to reside on. And the Secret Service has this down to a science. Now, the Secret Service has had some, you know, fairly well-publicized problems recently. But when it comes to advance work for a presidential visit, when it comes to actually managing that, you know, they're you know, as good as it gets out there. They're very, very, very good. And so they work closely with the local law enforcement. They come in for the advance. They do the drills. They walk them through how the movement's going to take place. And the local police, they drill, they exercise, they you know, focus on what their part of the mission is going to be. There's route planning, obviously, that's involved. There's, you know, security concerns in terms of the site security itself, perimeter security, and access problems. And, you know, then it kicks off. It's a massive operation, which is why, you know, people look at the cost of moving the president around And you look at Air Force One, but you look at all the security apparatus that's involved, including, you know, communications gear, because you have to have constant redundant communications capability wherever the president goes, and the number of personnel, vehicles that are involved. And it's a logistical nightmare, but they've got the processes and protocols down pat.
Right, and you have the Hercules or whatever that carries the cars and such and everything else. I'm just amazed that for a brief visit, again, you have the routes, you have the medical facilities, you have this, and then there's the threat assessment. And I will say this, I was amazed on social media how many idiots were saying stupid things about the president.
Yeah.
Look, you've lived in that world. You still do. Why do people say dumb things that they have no really – and every threat has to be taken seriously. They're not going to follow through with it, but they want to say stupid things.
Right. You have to evaluate, particularly now in this environment where obviously we've had a real upsurge in terrorist incidents and concerns around the world with the rise of the Islamic State. And unfortunately – the president got it wrong when he talked about the State of the Union and the Islamic State, and we've stopped their advance. We haven't. Al-Qaeda is resurgent. So we have a lot of problems. So when people get out there, and something as simple as just voicing their dissent over the president and his positions and whatever it may be, it would be nice if, just like in business, you would think twice before you push that send button or that tweet button or whatever it is, because – you know, the security service has to look at all of that. If they don't, imagine what would happen if there was an incident and they said, well, you know, for privacy reasons or because we just didn't want to crawl up in everybody's grill, we didn't really focus on any of this. Well, of course, there'd be an outcry. Same thing. If you do it, then, of course, people are upset because, well, why are you focusing on this? This is just citizens voicing their concerns. So you have to be smart about it. Obviously, it's an emotive issue. You know, people one side or the other with the president. You got to respect the office. I don't care whether you like the person who holds the office, whether you don't like their policies, whatever it may be. But you have to respect the office, and therefore you have, again, whether it's a Republican or Democratic president, you have to extend some courtesy, some respect. And that's really important, and I'm afraid that's breaking down here. And that trickles down then to the next generation. The youngsters hear it from their parents. It's not good.
Mike Baker with us. He's all good. 580 KIDO. Kevin Miller in the morning. Always enjoy getting the knowledge from him. So before we get into ISIS and everything else, and I really want to get into your world as a private company, assessing threat assessment, looking at kidnapping, and how to stop it from a private company corporate point of view. Let's talk a little bit about your part-time job or jobs. How many networks are you on now?
Yeah, I know it's a tough gig. It's not really that difficult, frankly. I do a lot of punditry. I don't even know what you call it. Pontification, blowing smoke.
Well, you're our expert here, so
yeah. No, I appreciate that. I've got a long-term sort of relationship with Fox. I actually do a fair amount of work on behalf of CNN. And
they let you do both, then.
They let me do both. And in part, you know, it's I think it's important. It's just like saying, look, I read the Wall Street Journal. I read the New York Times. I watch CNN. I watch Fox. You've got to get your information from all sides. You can't allow yourself to get locked into one line of information, one line of reporting, because that, reinforces what you think. Well, that's great. And everybody likes to hear what they think. But you've got to know all sides in order to make, you know, sound, rational decisions. And we're kind of moving into this weird place where, you know, we're screaming at each other from opposite points. And, you know, nobody's residing in the part where you can actually find compromise. In fact, compromise is actually becoming a nasty word in some circles, both on the right and on the left. And you've got to, when I get something done, you know, we're going to have to get back to that point. You know, the founding fathers spent all their time negotiating and compromising. That's what they did. But anyway, so what we do is, aside from the news punditing, I got involved in hosting, co-hosting shows on Travel Channel and other networks, depending on what the project was. We just finished filming 15 episodes of a show called World Access, which will be airing. They've got to come up with the air date. It'll be Sunday evenings, but it'll be on the Travel Channel. And basically traveling all over the country, getting off the beaten path, seeing how great this place is if you just work a little bit harder. So people go to the Grand Canyon. Well, you know what? If you travel about 3 or 4 hours outside the Grand Canyon, you see some amazing things. But people don't go there. So, you know, you get down to the Everglades. If you go, you know, just a little bit off the beaten path in the Everglades, you see some things that are just incredible. This country has a tremendous amount to offer, but you have to sometimes work to get there. And that's what the show's about. And it's been good. It's great. It's always nice to get out and remind yourself how fortunate we are, I think, to be here.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you must be a master of time management. You got your family, got your company, you got your responsibilities for Fox and CNN, and then they haul you across the country to do these things. I mean, yeah. Off the beaten path for you and for a guy like me are two totally different things.
Well, that's actually very funny. You know what? I'm very fortunate. I'm married to the world's smartest, most good-natured, funniest, I think, most beautiful woman, and she is a master of kind of organization and keeping things running, and she's a wonderful, wonderful mother. So on the home front, I'm very, very, very lucky because everything just talk about running like clockwork. And she's very helpful to me as well because she knows otherwise I'm a bit of a disorganized mess. And she's very good at helping to manage my own time. So I've handed over control of all aspects of my life to my wife.
Well, you heard it here first, yeah. Yes. Mike Baker with us, Kevin Miller in the morning here at 580 KIDO. Now, as far as your other shows, are you going to be doing anything else as far as swimming away from Alcatraz or anything else?
Yeah, we've got some interesting things coming up in this next series. We went down to the Everglades and hunted for Burmese python. These things grow to 25, 26, 27 feet in length. They're invasive, very invasive species. They're eating everything down there, including the panthers that are remaining, alligators. So we went down to the Everglades to do that.
Now, hold on. You've got to describe that.
You know what we did? We went out at night.
So here you are. You're in Idaho. You've done all these things. You've been to these exotic locations. Now you're hunting this python.
Yeah, and the Everglades, the funny thing about the Everglades, and not all that funny, is that everything down there wants to bite you in the backside. The bugs, the animals, the lizards, the plants. And so we went down there, and we worked with this sounds so odd, a professional python hunter.
Okay.
That's pretty much what Ruben does. He's a great, great local guy, great local character, and he kind of makes his living hunting pythons because they want to try to catch as many as they can. They're not going to get ahead of the problem. There are just too many of them.
Really?
Yeah. What they had was, this is a fascinating story. I don't want to get down in the weeds, although I am, but they had an exotic pet warehouse on the edge of the Everglades. And when Hurricane Andrew, which was enormously destructive, blew through years ago, it just blew this warehouse down and pushed all these exotic snakes and lizards into the Everglades. And these things have been breeding like rabbits.
Well,
that's probably the wrong way to say it.
Yes, hold that thought. More coming up with Mike Baker next. You're listening to 580.
Dave Ramsey, weekdays at noon. Now back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO. Idaho's first radio station.
Kevin Miller in the morning. We continue on with Mike Baker, who is hunting pythons in the Everglades, among his many other traits. So you're down there. This big storm comes in. It moves all of these dangerous creatures into one locale. And the python problem is so bad that they'll never be able to control them?
All they're trying to do now is keep them from moving outside the Everglades. They've decided that the management down there, the Fish and Wildlife and others have decided they're not going to get ahead of the curve and solve the problem inside the Everglades. So they're basically just trying to keep it contained and also do what they can to minimize the growth of these things. And there's others, the tegu lizard and a variety of others that resulted in this problem. But anyway, so we were mucking around in the middle of the Everglades, you know, up to our necks, and it's an incredible environment. But at nighttime, you have to go out and hunt these things at night for the most part, and then you set traps, and then you go out and
you wear night vision or anything?
You can wear night vision. It's not quite as high tech as you would imagine. You would hope for, yes. Hope for would be that you have someone else do it. But it was a lot of fun, and it was nobody got bit. And so we spent about 3 days down there and into the evenings and night, and it was really a lot of fun. But we do that. We traveled over all this country. We went to New Orleans for a fascinating look at voodoo, which is an amazing religion down there. And most people think of voodoo and they think of, you know, voodoo doll and, you know, sort of the old movies. But it's a religion,
right?
You know, that came up from Haiti, and you know, is a very important part of New Orleans.
How'd they get along with you?
You know what? It's an interesting. It was an interesting experience. Let me put that. I spent some time with a voodoo priestess. Went to a very unusual voodoo ceremony one night. And the most unusual part of that was I was standing there watching this voodoo ceremony, and Zooey Deschanel walked in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the actress.
Right.
And I looked at her and I thought, I think that's Zooey Deschanel.
Right.
And so I had previously tried to I sent a text to my wife and said, look, because she was in New Orleans with me, and I said, I wouldn't bother coming out to this thing. The place is covered in mosquitoes. It's kind of a weird, you know, vibe. Let's just meet up afterwards for dinner. And so she said, yeah, that sounds absolutely correct. And so then, after Zooey Deschanel, I walked back out to talk to the producers before we started another bit. And I sent her a text. I said, you know, the oddest thing, Zooey Deschanel is here.
Right.
So my wife showed up about 5 minutes later in a cab. She said, oh, I got to check this out. Anyway, it was a great thing. But we saw some amazing things around this country and did some great things. And that's one of those things. I think it's you can fall into a rut sometimes. Over the places you go or the things that you do. And again, people laugh sometimes overseas. I've seen it all the time, mocking Americans for not having passports. You know, I forget what the current percentage is. It's a single-digit number of Americans that actually possess a passport. And they all make fun of it, and they think, oh, you know, isn't that charming and how colloquial. And the reason that I tell them is, look, we live in a massive country. You can't imagine if you're in Europe and you're talking to someone from Belgium,
right.
They just don't get it. They don't understand. And say you could spend your entire life here and coast to coast, up and down, and never see everything that's amazing about this place. So that's why I've really enjoyed the Travel Channel show. But anyway, so we'll see where it takes us next.
I have to ask you, how do you catch a Burmese python?
I tend to lull it to sleep by talking to it about, you know, my theories on politics and terrorism. And then eventually it starts to doze off and I just pick it up. You have to, again, it's very low key. You're carrying a snake stick. It sounds so simple.
You don't have a net or anything?
Well, you do have a net or a pillowcase or something you want to stuff it in.
How big are they?
The ones we were catching were 18 to 23 foot.
And you've got a stick.
Yeah, and they're nasty, too. The other thing is they're really nasty. They want to bite you. Everything down there wants to bite you. And so what you have to do is you have to distract it. It's the old left-hand, right-hand thing. So you distract it, you know, and then you grab it by the tail and stretch it out and kind of keep it stretched out. You use the snake stick to kind of get its neck. So there's two people involved. And then somebody has to actually put their hand right behind the snake's mouth to get a hold of it, usually with two hands, depending on the size. And you pick it up and I know this sounds very low tech, but I'm telling you, this is what happens. And you stuff it into the bag or the pillowcase or whatever you're carrying. And you wind it up and you carry it and you hand it over to the researchers. The researchers use these things to try to study and understand how bad the problem is, what
sure.
they're eating. But these things are eating alligators. These things are eating everything. They don't discriminate. They'll eat everything.
Did you see any big alligators?
Oh, yeah. 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 There was one that refused to move out of our way. But we had to go back and forth because we had put the airboats on one side. And this guy just refused to leave because he had found a small little water hole. It was not much more than a puddle. And he was not going to move. And so it was interesting. The Everglades are a fascinating place. I wouldn't want to spend a lot of time there at nighttime, you know, up to my neck in the muck. But doing it once is good.
Before we move on to everything else here, Mike Baker, what part of the filming was it? The Everglades? Was it the voodoo? Can you tell us any favorite one that made a big impression, the biggest impression on you?
You know, I think actually of the two seasons so far, I'll tell you what made the biggest impression on me was the episode that we did, the first season down in Memphis about Martin Luther King. And we looked at the assassination of Martin Luther King. And the reason why that was such a big impression was because I spent several hours sitting talking to a fellow named Billy Kiles, Reverend Kiles. And Reverend Kiles was a close friend, confidant of Jesse Jackson and Martin Luther King and the entire group that was involved in the movement at that time. And they were at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. Billy Kiles was in the hotel room, in the motel room with Dr. King. And they were just kind of relaxing because they were going over to Billy Kiles' house to have dinner. And they come out of the motel room on the second floor onto the balcony of the motel room. And they're just kind of leaning over the balcony, talking to Jesse Jackson and a couple of others that are down there waiting for them to come down and get in the car so they can drive over to Billy Kyle's house. And Billy's standing next to Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King gets shot and killed And Billy Cowles was standing there and then was there while he was dying on the balcony.
And you were on that balcony with him, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah. And so to have a chance to stand there and then to kind of sit there right on the spot where Martin Luther King passed away and talking to Billy Cowles about what that meant and how he's dealt with it, how he thinks about it every day of his life. I mean, how do you, you know, when do you get to do that? And so you realize you got to, you know, you step back every now and then and think that's a really special moment.
Right. Yeah. And on the other end, though, and by the way, you can still get that show because they're running it all the time. And you'll have to tell us the name of the show.
That was America Declassified was the name of that show. And then we switched the title to World Access because that's what TV does.
America Declassified. But I mean, then they had you trying to take the shot that killed King, you know, to look
Kennedy.
At.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Kennedy. Well, no, you're right. Yeah. We
right.
also did a, we did some ballistic testing on the Martin Luther King thing.
Where you actually got in the, and this is strange, Mike, that I know this, but that you got in the bathtub, I believe, because the window was by the bathtub and how comfortable that would be from a real life scenario of actually making that shot. So you had both extremes.
We did. The boarding house where James Earl Ray took the shot from the bathroom, the common bathroom that was there in the and looked out over onto the Lorraine Motel. And James Earl Ray, you know, he'd done his homework and he had seen enough media at that time. People talked about these things openly, even though it was clear that, you know, Martin Luther King was a target of sorts. So James Earl Ray had figured out that this common area bathroom was the best opportunity for him, and yet it was not an easy shot because of the bathtub and the positioning of it and where the window was and how he had to. So we couldn't go into the actual bathroom because it's now sealed off as a memorial site. But we reconstructed the bathroom basically, all the exact down to the last quarter inch, and we worked on the shot. The shot was certainly doable. And it just shows the different in time, just like with JFK. It shows, and we talk about, you know, the president's current visit and the upgrade in security and the things that have developed over the years to try to protect people in those positions. And it's a completely different world now. But back then, in the early 60s, people were just accessible.
My favorite Mike Baker story about America Declassified is when you're running around Dealey Plaza with the rifle and you go to the producers, hey, we've got clearance for this, right? Oh, it's TV. We're good.
Yeah. Yeah, first time in 50 years we got permission from the authorities to take that shot from behind the picket fence just to see what it would look like.
Right.
And, you know, so we're standing there behind the picket fence, and they've stopped vehicle traffic, but they can't stop pedestrian traffic. And the place is jammed at Dealey Plaza, which is a very fascinating place to be, and everyone should make a trip down there when they get a chance. And I'm telling the producers, this is Texas. And most, producers are from California. They don't understand. Everybody's carrying a weapon.
Right.
So I said, look, this is all well and good. You guys are far enough away from me that you'll be probably fine.
Right.
But I'm going to start firing this rifle, and there's a good chance people are going to start firing back. And it was – but when that first shot went off and you saw the pedestrians freeze, it was a fascinating thing. So that was another good – a lot of good events. We've been very fortunate with the Travel Channel. And I should say Indigo Films. Indigo Films is a production company that does these things. And I'll take the opportunity to say they're a terrific bunch of people, David Frank and the others.
Yeah, they're pretty high-speed guys.
Yeah.
They are. More coming up with Mike Baker next, 580KIDO.
Good morning, Kevin. I listen to you every morning. Everything's going to be okay, regardless of who's leading this country. This is in God's hands.
Good morning to you.
I agree to that 100%.
It says food for your brain. Well, how about let's feed some brains this morning?
Food for your brain. Kevin Miller, 580 KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
580 KIDO, Kevin Miller in the morning, Mike Baker with us as we now get to the unfortunate stuff, the world we live in. Mr. Baker, let's first talk about the President's State of the Union, talking about we're leaving Afghanistan, we've left Iraq, we've ended everything. Is the world a better place now?
I'm sorry. I should be more poker-faced about that, shouldn't I? The President at the State of the Union speech, in terms of what's going on overseas in the war on terror, he described a world that I don't understand where he's residing. The world that he described is the world that he would like to see. It doesn't describe the world as it exists currently. And by that, I mean he barely gave it any time at all anyway, a couple of paragraphs. But when you talk about, you know, the shadow of crisis is past and we have stopped the advance of the Islamic State and we're working with our partners, you know, and it's all, it's not reality. It's not fact-based. But it is a perfect example of how he and the administration have been dealing with these problems. They set foreign policy based on how they would like to see the world, not on how the world is actually performing and acting and reacting. So, yes, we have problems. We have the biggest problem we've got right now is that we're currently facing more threats than we've seen in the past decade. And at the same time, over the past couple of years, because we're all tired of the war on terror, we've been dismantling some of the apparatus. And by that, I mean little bits and pieces of the war on terror. Because, you know, the pendulum swung back and we're tired of the war on terror and we want to get back to focusing on other things and, you know, hey, let's focus on privacy and individual rights. And that's a good thing. You always want to make sure you're doing the right balance. But as an example, the DOJ advising law enforcement they can't use religion as a factor when doing threat profiling. You know, are we insane?
Right.
It's similar to the fact that they can't identify the problem. President Hollande from France, General al-Sisi from Egypt, everybody out there is saying this is an Islamic jihadist, you know, Muslim extremist problem. We're the only ones that start out every sentence by saying it's important to say this is not a war on Islam. We're looking at violent extremism in all its forms. What a bunch of tools. They can't describe the problem after all these years, still. And, of course, it's not a war on Islam. Any you know, knucklehead knows that. But we have to be able to say it, and along with the other world leaders who are saying it. I just don't understand it. And the Democrats, who in the past would have exorcised President Bush for some mealy mouth like this, now they look at you and go, well, it doesn't matter. What does it matter if you call it that? It doesn't matter if you do that. You know, it's a pathetic situation we face.
Psychologically, social media-wise, never mind the way they carry out their terrorist attacks, how is ISIS different from anything that we've ever fought before?
Well, fundamentally, it's not different. 30,000 feet, it's still, you know, Islamic extremism. And so, in a sense, that aspect's not different. What makes it more difficult right now, the reason why we're seeing the increase in problems, is because of the territory that they've taken. And we know what happens. When al-Qaeda had the comfort of existing in Afghanistan prior to 9/11, that's when they spent all their time plotting and planning and preparing to attack the West, whether it was 9/11 or whether it was attacks in the European Union, wherever. And so we know what already happens when they have that ability. So the Islamic State, which is an offshoot of al-Qaeda, basically, you know, right. It grew out of an internal dispute. I wouldn't make too much of that dispute because these guys will cooperate whenever it means they can screw us. And so they've now got this territory. It gives them the comfort of being able to plot, plan, prepare, recruit. And the recruit is actually very, very important because from a public relations standpoint, they get out there in social media now. And they're encouraging and they're telling people, we've now got it. We've got our caliphate. The physical manifestation of a caliphate that we've been talking about for decades and decades and decades, we now have it. That is a very strong message to all those disaffected, unemployed, easily influenced Muslim youth out there who have no place to hang their hat and live in France or live in Spain or live in Germany or live here or wherever, but don't feel a part of anything. Don't feel a part of the system. And it's also a powerful message for the psychos and the nut jobs who will go out and latch onto it simply because, well, okay, it sounds good, and they'll go out and they'll commit a terror. From the radical Islamic extremist point of view, they don't care whether they're convincing through social media a devout Muslim to go out and do an operational act or a nutcase. They don't care. We're the ones who get wrapped around the axle. So something happens in New York and go, but look, a guy was clearly a nut, you know, or somewhere else. Oh, he had a criminal past, you know, and you think it doesn't matter from the Islamic perspective. They just want the violence. They want the terror.
Based on what you're doing professionally now, what you have done, how prevalent will it be or how reliable will it be that we eventually will be attacked here? And, you know, the work that you do behind the scenes and the people in the government to prevent those attacks.
Well, I mean, the good news is we keep getting better. You know, state, local, federal law enforcement, intel communities. It's never going to be perfect because it's a human activity, but we keep getting better, unfortunately, because we have to keep working on it. And so much like we talked about with the security for the president, the vast majority of what goes on is behind the scenes and people don't see it. But it's not a happy coincidence that we haven't had another attack on our soil. The problem is that it will happen. I mean, there's no way around it. In the world of counterterrorism, you don't reduce the risk down to zero. So you prepare and you plan and you do everything you can to minimize and disrupt and prevent these attacks, but never with the thought that you're going to stop all of them. It just can't happen. And there's so much connectivity now between all the various players. So you have, look at France. The Paris attacks is an example. That brought in to play Algeria.
Right.
It brought into play Syria. It brought into play Iraq. It brought into play the extremist problem that they're having in France and the rest and Belgium and the rest of the EU. So all of these things, nothing happens in a bubble. And you know, we tend to want to simplify things and put it in a box and say, well, this is the problem here. This is the problem here. This is the problem here. Over the top of everything is the Islamic extremist problem within the broad Muslim community out there. And until the Muslim political leaders and religious leaders get out there and aggressively every day of every year, get out there and aggressively ostracize and beat down the extremists within their community until they drive them into a box and then figure out how to bury that box, we're not going to solve the problem. We can't do it ourselves. We can't kill our way out of it.
Sure, but do Western leaders have the political will to say these guys have to go? They're religious extremists, they're Islamic extremists, just like we did with the Nazis and the commies and everything else. We seem to not want to offend people when they want to kill us.
Well, look, again, every time the administration opens their mouth about this problem, they start out by saying, you know, it's important to say we're not against, it's not a war against Islam. That's where they start from. Well, you know what we should have done after the Paris, everybody talked about, oh, the unity of the Paris March. What a load of crap. You know, just because Turkey sent a couple of leaders, 2 days later, Erdogan, the head of Turkey, was screaming about how it was America's fault and playing back to his masses again. There's no unity. The only leader so far in the Muslim community that's really stepped out against this problem in a strong way was in a speech by General Sisi of Egypt. And he came out and gave a speech in a Christian Coptic church, and he talked about, essentially that's the cancer of Islamic extremism, and they have to, meaning the Muslim world has to deal with this. We should have invited al-Sisi to the White House after that. And what's the White House talking about? They're having a forum. They're having a conference on all forms of violent extremism.
Right.
That's their response to the Paris attacks. So they're going to look at all forms of violent extremism. We should gather up all the leaders, use our leverage that we've got left in the Middle East, gather all the leaders of the Muslim world together and sit down with them and very – whatever we have to do. You know, strong arm them if we have to, but explain that we've been sending huge amounts of money to the Middle East, you know, and that's got to stop if we can't get them on side to
right.
deal with this problem. Now, of course, they're all acting in their own best interests. You know, they're balancing, you know, their own survival of their own regime with playing off, you know, not being a puppet of the West and not. But this is going to bring them down. The Saudis are worried. The Jordanians are worried. Everybody is worried out there. The UAE. You know, if they all think that the Islamic State's going to draw a curtain around territory they've got now and not go after them, they're insane. So it's in their best interest at some point, and that's when it's going to happen. When they feel like they're going to collapse, that this problem is going to come and bite them in the backside, that's when we'll actually see some action. Until that happens, we can't get ahead of the curve.
Mike Baker with us as we continue on. Kevin Miller in the morning, 580 KIDO, time for traffic. Good morning, Dave.
Good.
Glenn Beck. Weekdays at 9. Now back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
580 KIDO, Kevin Miller with you here. Mike Baker, we continue on taking a look at the attacks in France and throughout the region. What more can we expect in the coming months from ISIS and their franchises, if you will?
Well, in a nutshell, they'll continue doing what they're doing. Trying to gain more territory, trying to gain better control over what they've got in Syria and Iraq. They've already moved into Afghanistan. Pakistani Taliban elements have already pledged their allegiance to the Islamic State. They will continue a very heavy effort in social media. And basically, one of the interesting things that we're seeing now with the Islamic State and their social media effort, and really it falls into al-Qaeda as well, is they're no longer just saying, make your way to Syria, come to Iraq, come join the fight, come join the jihad. They're saying, if you can't get to us, do whatever you can where you are. Just get it done. If you happen to be there, then you can join the fight by doing something in wherever you happen to reside. That's a very dangerous thing. But we're seeing some, depends on the estimates you read, some 5,000 or so individuals, foreigners, back and forth now to Syria and Iraq. Just like the Qureshi brothers in Paris that committed that Charlie Hebdo attack. So that's a major problem. Right after 9/11, we talked about Al-Qaeda's efforts to try to recruit people in the West. And this is just a manifestation of that effort that's been going on for years now. And we are taking it seriously. But, you know, again, the problem here in the U.S. is that we're so tired of it. We're so tired of the war on terror. But I think what happened in Paris and what's happened in Sydney and Melbourne and New York and elsewhere has refocused us. And I'm hopeful that we will actually take the steps necessary to degrade ISIS in Syria and Iraq. If we can't take that territory back and deny them that comfort, then this is going to be going on and on and on.
Mike Baker, we've got about a minute left. Are you surprised that the journalism folks in France, Charlie Hebdo and I, were shocked that they would be attacked? I mean, you know this. You deal with the bad guys. You don't do certain things.
Yeah, they've known they've been a target for some time now. They had actually changed locations after their previous location was firebombed, and so they were aware of it. French intelligence, which is very good, very capable, and the French law enforcement were aware of it, but they didn't take sufficient steps, I would argue. And that's, you know, it's armchair quarterbacking. Everybody hates to do that. But they have to do a hot wash after the attack, and they're doing that to figure out what went wrong. Now, frankly, the best opportunity we would have had to pick this up and to figure out that something was about to happen would have been the final stages of surveillance that the hostiles went through prior to the attack. You have to pick a target. This was easy because they knew they wanted to go after Charlie Hebdo. This attack was greenlit years ago by Al-Laki and AQAP. But they have to do the surveillance, and then they figure out how they're going to get in, out. They have to handle the weapons. They have to figure out how they're going to do that. They get communications and all that. So all of that's going on. We may not pick up on that unless we have really good communications intercepts or maybe a human source. And then they have to do their final surveillance. They're going to get in there. They're going to make one last effort. Okay, yeah, we kind of got it. We figured out. They back off. And that's when you're not going to pick up anything because it all goes quiet.
Right.
So I would argue that if there's any place where you could look and say we probably – that should have been stepped up. It should have been counter-surveillance on that site, counter-surveillance on the principals in Charlie Hebdo at their residences, and just lock that down more than they did. But it's all, again, it's all armchair quarterbacking.
We like that here. Mike Baker, thank you, sir.
Sure, thank you.
You're listening to
KIDO.